Ethis, who brought me up and cherished me in their own house. I want to reconcile their old quarrel, for they have been at odds this long time, and keep apart in bed and board for some grudge or other. My horses are down at the foot of the mountain, ready to carry me over moist and dry. You are the reason why I came here. I was afraid you might be angry with me afterwards if I go to the house of Oceanus without telling you.
Zeus, Cloud-Gatherer, answered, My dear, you can go there by and by. But now let us to bed and take our joy. Indeed, no love of goddess or woman has ever come over me like this in a flood and possessed my heart, not when I was in love with the daughter of famous Phoenix, who brought me Minos and Rhadamanthus, not when I loved Semele or Alchemy in Thebes, and one brought me mighty Heracles, one Dionysus, the darling of the world, not when I loved glorious Leto, nor indeed yourself. Never was I in love so deeply as I love you now, and sweet desire holds me captive. His artful queen said, You dreadful creature, what a thing to say! You want to make love on the top of a mountain where anyone can see. What if one of us gods should see us asleep and go and tell tales to the whole family? I couldn't get up from this bed and go straight home. I should be ashamed.
If it is really your wish, if you are bent upon it, there's my room for you, built by Hephaestus, with good strong doors. Let us go and lie there, since you are pleased to desire bed.
Zeus, Cloud-Gatherer, answered, My dear, you need not be afraid that god or man will see. I will gather about us such a golden cloud that Helios himself could not see through, and his sunlight is the strongest light there is. As he spoke, he took his wife in his arms. And under them the earth divine made a bed of fresh new grass to grow, with dewy clover and crocus and hyacinth soft and thick, which raised them high above the ground. There they lay, and a beautiful golden cloud spread over them, from which fell drops of sparkling dew. While the father lay motionless on the top of Gargarus, mastered by love and sleep, with his wife in his arms, sleep ran quickly to the Achaean ships with news for Poseidon Earthshaker. As soon as he came near enough, he blurted out, Have your way now, Poseidon. Help the Danians. Give them victory just for a little, while Zeus is still asleep. I have drowned him in soft slumber myself. Hera has enticed him to bed with her. Then he was gone to his work among the nations of mankind. But he left Poseidon more eager than ever to support the Danians. He leapt to the front and shouted, Look here, men, are we going to let Hector Priamides beat us again? Is he to take our ships and triumph? That's what he says, that is his boast, because Achilles is in the sulks and keeps out of it. We shall not miss the man much if we do our best to help ourselves. Listen to me now, and do what I tell you. Let us take the best and biggest shields in the camp, and put on the most shining helmets, and seize the longest spears we can find, and then, forwards, I will lead you, and I don't think Hector Priamides will stand before my charge. If there is a staunch fighting man who has only a small buckler, let him give it to some worse fellow with a larger shield and take his. So Tydides and Odysseus and King Agamemnon marshaled them in spite of their wounds, and went about everywhere changing the gear. The good man took the good armor and gave his worse gear to a worse man. When all was properly arranged, they marched forward. Poseidon Earthshaker led them like a thunderbolt of war, holding a terrible sword, long and sharp. No man may meddle with him in the deadly combat, but fear holds them back. On the other side, Hector marshaled his forces. Then came the most dreadful tug-of-war between sea-blue hair Poseidon and Hector the brilliant hero, the Trojans behind one, the Argives behind the other. The sea rolled up to the Argive camp and ships, and the armies met with deafening war cries. Not so loud are the waves of the sea booming against the land when it rolls in from the deep before the blusterous northeaster. Not so loud is the roar in the glens of a blazing mountain when fire leaps upon the forest. Not so loud is the shrieking wind in the treetops, the angriest wind that roars, as the terrible noise of Trojans and Achaeans shouting and yelling while they leap to their struggle for life and death. Hector first cast a spear at Aeas, who was turned full towards him. That cast was no miss. He struck his chest in the place where the shield strap and sword strap crossed. They saved his body from a wound. Hector was angry that his cast had no effect and stepped back into safety. As he retired, Aeas picked up a large stone. There were many such knocking about under the feet of the men, mooring stones for the ships. One of these Aeas lifted high and threw it at Hector. The stone went over the shield rim and, striking his chest near the neck, sent him spinning like a top with the blow. Round and round he went all over the place and fell flat in the dust. He was like a tree struck by lightning and torn up by the roots, with a vile smell of sulphur, enough to daunt anyone who saw it close, for dangerous is the thunderbolt of Zeus. The spear fell from his hand, helmet and shield collapsed over him in a heap, his armor crashed and clanged about him. Then the Achaeans ran at him, shouting, volleying, stabbing, hoping to drag him off. But no one could touch him, for there were good men about him by this time, Polydamas and Aeneas and Agenor, Sarpedon the Lycian and Glaucus, and the others also did their parts, holding their round shields before him. His friends lifted him with their hands and carried him out of the battle to the rear, where the driver was waiting with horses and chariot. So he was driven back towards the city, groaning heavily. When they reached the ford of the river Xanthos, they laid him on the ground and poured water over him. Upon this he came to himself and opened his eyes. He sat up on his knees and vomited blood. Then he fell back upon the ground, still dazed from the blow, and his eyes closed again. The Argives assaulted more furiously than ever when they saw Hector retire. Aeas the runner first of all leapt upon Satnios, the son of a water naiad who was born while his father was tending herds beside the river Satniois. Aeas caught him up and stabbed him in the flank, which laid him flat, and there was a general combat about his body. Polydamas Panthuides, defending him, threw his spear at Prothoenor. It ran through the right shoulder, and Prothoenor fell, clutching at the earth. Polydamas shouted loud in triumph, "Lo and behold, there's one more spear not wasted when it leaps from the firm hand of Panthuides. One of the Argives has caught it in his body, and he will have something to lean on as he hobbles down to Hades." This taunt infuriated the Argives, and Aeas in particular, the Telamonian, I mean, who was close by where the man fell. Quickly he made a cast while Polydamas was moving back. Polydamas dodged aside and saved himself, but it caught Archelochus, Antenor's son, who was doomed by Providence to die, as it seems. The point struck where head and neck joined at the top of the spine and cut through both sinews. Head and nose and mouth hit the ground before legs and knees came near it. Then Aeas shouted out, "Think a moment, Polydamas, and answer me truly. Is not that man's life a fair price for Prothoenor? He does not seem to me a common man or a son of common people. He must be Antenor's brother, or his son. He is exactly like him in looks." He knew him well all the while, but his taunt provoked the Trojans. Then Acamas straddled across his brother and stabbed Boeotian Promachos, who was trying to drag the body away by the feet. Acamas shouted out triumphantly, "Champion bowmen you Argives are, and too fond of boasting. I don't think we shall be the only ones to suffer in sorrow. Some of you shall die here beside us. See how your Promachos lies asleep, and my spear brought him down. I would not have my brother's blood prize long unpaid. That is why a man prays to have one of his kinsmen left, that he may save the family from disgrace." This boasting speech enraged the Argives, and Peneleos most of all. He rushed at Acamas, but Acamas did not wait for him, so he attacked Alyonius. This man was the only son of Phorbas, whom Hermes loved most of all the Trojans, and blessed his wealth, so that his flocks were many. Peneleos stabbed him at the root of the eye, under the brow, and tore out the eyeball. The spear went through the eye and out at the nape of the neck, and the man sank down, stretching out both hands. Peneleos drew his sword and cut right through the neck. Head and helmet fell to the ground, with the spear still sticking in the eye. Then Peneleos held it up for the Trojans to see like a poppy head on a long stalk, and cried, exulting, "Kindly send word to the father and mother of his honour, Alyonius, to arrange for the mourning of their son at home." for the wife of Procomus Alaginorides is in the same case. She will not have the joy of meeting her beloved husband when we Achaeans return home from Troy." They trembled in every limb to hear these words, and each man looked about to see how he might escape death. Now the battle had turned, and many of the Achaeans lifted the blood spoils of their enemies. Telamonian Aeus stabbed Hyrtios Gyrtiades, the mission captain. Antilochus despoiled Phalces and Myrmeros. Meriones killed Morus and Hippotion. Teucros brought down Perthoon and Periphetes. Then Atreides stabbed Prince Hipparinor in the side and let out his bowels. His soul flew quickly out of the wound, and darkness covered his eyes. But Aeus Oeliades killed more than any other, for he was a quick runner, and no man was like him for running down those who ran away when Zeus put fear into their hearts. Book 15. How Zeus awoke, and what he said to Hera. How Hera took his message to the divine family, and what they all said to it, and how the two armies fought among the ships. Thus the Trojans were driven over the moat and stakes, and many had fallen. Now they halted beside their chariots, pale with fear, terror-stricken. But Zeus awoke on Mount Ida by the side of Hera, his consort. He sprang up and stood, looking at the battlefield. There were the Trojans in rout. There were the Achaeans, pelting in pursuit, with Lord Poseidon among them. There was Hector lying on the plain, and his companions sitting around him, and he, dazed, breathing heavily, vomiting blood, for no weak hand had dealt that blow. The father of the gods and men was moved with pity to see the man, and he said to Hera with an angry frown, "This is another of your evil schemes, you unmanageable creature. Your trick has driven him from the battle and routed his people. I should not be surprised if you were sorry by and by for your wicked web-spinning, when you get the first taste of the fruit and a good thrashing from me. Don't you remember how I hung you up with two great stones tied to your feet and a golden chain round your wrists, too strong for anyone to break? There you dangled in the clouds. The gods were indignant, but they could not go and set you free. Anyone I caught, I picked up and hurled from the threshold, and down he came to the earth with very little breath left in his body. Even that could not console me for my intolerable anxiety about Heracles when you seduced the storms to send him before the north wind over the sea and then landed him in Kos, another of your mischievous plots. I saved him from Kos indeed and brought him back to Argos after many hardships. I'll give you cause to remember all this and stop your deceits. You shall soon find out if you get any good by your loving and your bedding and by coming all this way to deceive me." Hera shivered at these words and protested, "I call on earth to witness, and the broad heavens above, and the force of Styx, which is the most solemn oath for the blessed gods, and your sacred head, and our own marriage-bed, which I would never lightly name. It is not my doing that Poseidon Earthshaker plagues Hector and the Trojans, and helps the other side. I suppose his own temper moves him, and pity for the Achaeans hard-pressed beside their own ships. Why, if he would take my advice, he would follow wherever you lead, Thundercloud." The father of gods and men smiled and answered very much to the point, "Ah, yes, my dear lady, if only you could have one mind with me as you sit in our family circle, Poseidon would soon change his mind to suit yours and mine, however much he might want something else. But if you are really speaking the truth, go home and tell Iris and Archer Apollo to come here. I want to send Iris to tell Poseidon that he must stop meddling in the war and go home. And I want Apollo to breathe courage into Hector again, and make him forget the pain that torments him, and send him back to the battle. The Achaeans are to be turned again in headlong flight, and to fall back on the ships of Achilles. He is to put up his friend Patroclus, and Hector is to kill Patroclus under the walls of Ilios, after he has killed many other fine fellows, and among them Sarpedon, my own son. Then Achilles, in revenge for Patroclus, is to kill Hector. After that I will make the Achaeans sweep the Trojans away from their camp completely, and they shall take the city according to Athena's plans. But meanwhile I will not relent, and I will not allow any other of the immortals to help the Danians here until I fulfill the desire of Pelides, as I promised to do, and bowed my head to confirm it, on that day when Thetis embraced my knees and prayed to me to give renown to Achilles. Hera durst not disobey. As quickly as the mind of a man can move when he had travelled far over the wide world and remembers many places, as he thinks, I would be there or there, and there he is. So Hera flew quick as thought from Ida to high Olympus. She found the immortal gods assembled in the hall of Zeus. All rose and held up their cups in welcome. She took no notice of the others, but she accepted the cup from Themis, who had run first to meet her, saying, without ceremony, "My dear Hera, why have you come? You seem upset. I'm sure your lord and master has given you a fright."
Hera replied, "Goddess alive, don't ask me. You know yourself what his temper is, the hard-hearted tyrant. Just sit down and take charge of this meal. I'll tell you about it, and everyone shall hear what wicked things he talks of doing. I don't think it will be equally pleasant to everyone, man or god, if there is any one of our party who still feels comfortable." Hera sat down as she spoke. Everyone in that hall was disquieted now. Hera laughed with her lips, but there was no warmth on the forehead above those black brows, as she turned towards the whole company and said with indignation, "We are fools to harbor rebellious thoughts against Zeus, just silly. We still want to walk up and put a stop to him by main force or by plain talk, and he sits by himself and takes no notice, simply doesn't care. He says he is the best god among us and the strongest, yes, decidedly. So you had better keep whatever nasty little gift he sends, each of you. There is one parcel of trouble, I believe, ready for Ares. His favorite son has been killed in battle. Ascalaphus. At least Ares calls him son." At this Ares slapped his two thighs with his open hands and cried out in dulcet tones, "Now don't be surprised, my good Olympians, if I go and pay out those Achaeans for my son's death. Yes, even if my fate is to be struck by a thunderbolt from on high, and I have to lie with a heap of corpses in the blood and dust. Here, terror and panic," he shouted, "my horses," and proceeded to put on his armor. And now there would have been another quarrel between Zeus and the whole family, worse and more dangerous than the quarrel in the Achaean camp. But Athena saw the danger for their own peace, left her seat, dashed out of the door after Ares, tore the helmet off his head and the corselet off his shoulders, pulled the spear from his fingers and put it back in the stand, and rated him roundly. "You're mad! You're crazy! You're done for! You have ears, but you don't hear. You have no sense or decency. Don't you take in what Hera says, straight from Olympian Zeus? Do you want to do no end of mischief, and then come home miserable, as you'll have to do, and bring disaster on all the rest of us? He will leave Trojans and Achaeans on the spot, and go for us, ramping into Olympus, grabbing one after another, innocent and guilty. Forget your son, I tell you. Many a better man and stronger man than he has perished, or will perish as time goes on. It is a difficult thing to save the whole human race." As she spoke, she pulled Ares back to his seat, still furious. But Hera called Apollo outside with Iris, who was the errand girl in the divine household, and said without more ado, "Zeus says you must go to Ida as quick as you can. When you have entered the presence, do what his lordship commands you." Hera went back to her seat. And the other two went flying to Mount Ida, where the wild beasts breed among the running brooks. There they found Cronides all-seeing, seated upon the heights of Gargarus, in the midst of sweet-scented clouds. They came and stood before Zeus cloud-gatherer, and he was not displeased that they had so quickly obeyed the summons. And first he told Iris her mission in a few plain words. "Off with you, Iris, my quick one. Give this message to Lord Poseidon, and be no untruthful messenger. Tell him to stop fighting, to leave the war and join the divine family, or go down into the sea. If he disregards my words and will not obey, tell him to consider carefully whether he is strong enough to stand up against me. Remind him that I am far more powerful than he is, and elder-born, yet he does not shrink from calling himself equal to me, whom the others fear."
Iris obeyed. Swift as the wind, she flew from Ida to Ilios, swift as the snow or hail which falls from a cloud when the cold blast of Boreas blows. She alighted beside the Earthshaker and spoke. "A message for you, Earthholder Sea-Blue Hair. I bring a message from Zeus Almighty. He bids you stop fighting and leave the war, to join the divine family or go down into the sea. If you disregard his words and will not obey, his lordship threatens to come to this place and fight you force against force. He bids you keep clear of his hands, for he says he is far more powerful than you are and the elder born, yet you do not shrink from calling yourself equal to him whom the others fear." The Earthshaker angrily replied, "Confound it, that is a tyrant's word, though he may be strong. I am his equal in rank, and he will constrain me by force. We are three brothers, the sons of Cronos and Rhea, Zeus and I, and Hades, who rules the lower world. All was divided among us in three parts, and each has his prerogative. We cast lots, and I got the sea, Hades the gloomy darkness, Zeus the broad heavens high amid the clouds. Earth and Olympus were left common to all. Therefore I will not live at the beck and call of Zeus. Let him enjoy his own share in peace, even if he is a strong one. But let him not think to scare me with his strong hands as if I were something contemptible. He would do better to try scolding and scaring his own sons and daughters, who must obey whether they like it or not."
Iris said, "Then that is your answer which I am to report to my master, Earthholder Sea-Blue Hair? So stubborn and stiff? Or will you change a bit? The noblest natures you will find are not too stiff to change their mind. You know how the avenging spirits always attend the elder born."
Then Poseidon Earthshaker answered, "Iris, my dear goddess, you are quite right. A messenger with news to bring should understand the proper thing. But I tell you, it hurts me through and through. When I am his partner, and I have an equal share, and yet he wants to scold me with angry words. Look here, I will give way, though it makes me indignant. But let me say something more. Here is a threat which I mean to carry out. If he goes against me, and Athena, and Hera, and Hermes, and Hephaestus, and spares Ilios, if he will not destroy this city and give victory to the Achaeans, between us two there will be hatred which nothing can heal."
With this, the Earthshaker left the battlefield and dived into the sea, and the Achaeans missed him badly.
Then Zeus Cloud-Gatherer said to Apollo, "Now, my dear Phoebus, you go to Hector. Earthshaker has disappeared into the sea at the threat of my wrath, or others would have heard of our feud. I mean the gods in the underworld, Cronos and the rest. But it is much better for us both that he kept clear of my hands, or the matter would not have been settled without sweat. Here, take my tasseled Aegis cape, shake it well over the Achaeans, and put them to flight. Your business, shoot afar, will be to take care of Hector. Inspire him with courage and strength until the Achaeans are driven right down to the Hellespont. After that I will consider what is necessary to do and say, that they may recover from their defeat."
Apollo shot down from Ida like the dove-killing falcon, the swiftest of winged things, and alighted near Hector, who was sitting up now. He had come to himself and knew his friends round him. The heavy breathing and sweating ceased when the will of Zeus revived him. Apollo said,
"Prince Hector, why are you here, fainting and far behind the others? Are you in trouble of any sort?"
Hector, half-dazed, replied,
"And who are you, most potent god, who stand before me asking these questions? Do you not know that Aeus knocked me down with a big stone in front of the ships and drove me out of the battle when I was killing his comrades? I really thought I was going to breathe out my last breath today and go down among the dead men."
Apollo said,
"Take courage when you see what a helper Cronion has sent from Ida to stand by you, Phoebus Apollo Goldensword, the same who has long protected you and your city. Now command your chariots to drive in a body upon the enemy ships. I will go before you and turn back the Achaeans and make a smooth road for your horses."
At once Hector was filled with new spirit. like a stallion horse which has fed his fill at the manger and breaks the halter. Off he goes, clattering over the plains, head high and mane flowing over his shoulders, while proudly he gallops along to the mare's feeding ground. So nimble foot, nimble knee Hector hurried about, ordering his men to do as the god commanded. And what of the battle? As countrymen with dogs hunt a horned stag or a wild goat, but steep rocks or dark thickets save him, since to catch him was not their lot. Then a bearded lion, disturbed by their cries, appears on the path, and suddenly drives them back from the chase. So the Danians all this while had been hunting their enemy in packs, and stabbing with spears and swords. But when they saw Hector ranging the ranks, they were afraid, and their hearts sank down to their heels. Then up spoke Thoas among them, the best man of the Aetolians, one who knew his spearcraft, and a good man also in a stand-up fight. In conference, too, there were few of the whole nation better when the young fellows debate together. Thoas kept his head and cried out, "Upon my word, here is a miracle which I see with my own eyes. Hector has escaped, and here he is, risen again. We all hoped he was really and truly dead, and Aeus Telamoniades had killed him. But some god has saved him again. He has killed many of our people, and I expect it will be the same now. The hand of Zeus Thunderer is in this, or he would not appear now full of fight in the front rank. Listen, and I will tell you what to do. We will order the main body to retreat towards the ships, and pick out the best men to make a stand and try to hold him off with spears in rest. I don't think even that furious man will be bold enough to plunge into a Danian square." Accordingly, Aeus and his pair, and Idomeneus, Teucros, and Meriones, and Meges, and their followers, summoned all the best fighting men to face Hector, while the main body began to retreat behind them. The Trojans thrust forward in a body, led by Hector in fine form. Before them went Phoebus Apollo with a cloud about his shoulders, holding the aegis cape, shaggy, conspicuous, terrible, made by Hephaestus for Zeus to carry and to confound mankind. Holding this in his hands, Apollo led the advance. The Argives stood in a mass to meet them, and a piercing war cry arose from both sides. Arrows leapt from the bowspring, spears shot from steady hands, some to pierce the bodies of strong young men, many to fall between ere they could taste the white flesh, and to stick in the ground, greedy for a taste. So long as Apollo held the aegis cape unmoving, the volleys hit their mark on both sides, and the people fell. But when he looked the Danians full in the face and shook it with a loud and terrible shout, he melted their hearts within them, and they forgot their courage. Then, like a herd of cattle or a great flock of sheep, chased by a couple of wild beasts in the murk of night, with a sudden attack when the keeper is away, so fled the Achaeans in panic, for Apollo put fear into them and gave victory to Hector and his Trojans. Then man struck man in the scattering battle. Hector killed Stichios and Arcesilaus, one of the chief of the Boeotian captains, the other the great friend of Meneseus. Aeneas brought down and stripped Medon and Iasus. Medon was a bastard son of Oileus and brother of Aeus, as has been told before. Iasus was the leader of the Athenians, the son of Sphilos Bucolides. Polydamas took Mesistius. Polites took Echios in the front rank. Aegina took Clonius. Paris struck Deiochus from behind in flight and ran him through the end of the shoulder. While they were stripping the armor from these men, the fugitives were tumbling over the stakes and moat and running in all directions and getting behind the wall as they could. So Hector shouted loudly to his men, "Leave the spoils and make for the ships. If I see any man anywhere else and not by the ships, I will kill him on the spot. His family shall never give him his due with fire, but carrion dogs shall tear him under the walls of our city." Then down from the shoulders he put the lash to his horses and called out to the ranks. All cheered and drove on with him with a devil of a din. Before them Phoebus Apollo leveled down the sides of the ditch with a touch of his feet and filled the hollow. Thus he built a long dam across as wide as a strong man's spear-cast. The men poured over it in mass, Apollo in front holding the precious aegis, and he threw down the wall as easily as a boy playing on the beach who builds his toy castles in the sand and shuffles them down again with his feet. So easily didst thou, O glorious Apollo, confound all the toil and travail of the Argives, and turn them to rout. So the Argives came to a halt beside their ships, appealing to one another, and, lifting up their hands to all gods, they prayed earnestly, every man. Geranium Nestor, most earnestly of all, raising his hands to heaven, offered his prayer. "Oh, Father Zeus, if ever a man of us in Argos has made burnt offering of bulls or sheep, and prayed for a safe return, remember that, Olympian. Save us from this cruel day, and let not Achaeans be thus conquered by Trojans." Zeus, all-wise, thundered loud, hearing the prayer of old Nelides. But the Trojans attacked still more furiously when they heard the thunder of Zeus Almighty. As a great billow from the open sea rolls over the bulwarks of a ship, when a strong wind piles it up as the winds do pile the waves, so the Trojans, with a mighty noise, came rolling over the wall, and driving their horses to the ships, they fought with spears, hand to hand, they from their chariots, the others from the ships where they had climbed, using the long-jointed pole shod with bronze which were there at hand. All this while, as long as the battle was outside the walls and far from the ships, Patroclus had been in the hut of gentle Eurypylus, amusing him with talk, and soothing the pain of his wound with plasters of his healing herbs. But when the Trojans came pouring in, and when he heard the noise of the Danians in rout, he groaned and slapped his thighs, saying in distress to his friend, "I can't stay here any longer, Eurypylus, although you need somebody with you, but just listen to this battle going on. Your man shall attend to you. I must hasten to Achilles and try to make him fight. Who knows whether I may not persuade him with good luck? The persuasion of a friend often brings a happy end." So saying, he went off as fast as his feet would carry him. The Achaeans held their own before the attack, but they could not push off the Trojans, though they were fewer, nor could the Trojans break the ranks in front of them and get among the ships and huts. The battle was evenly balanced, and kept as straight as a master carpenter's line in cutting a plank. There was fighting in many places, but Hector found himself opposite the ship of Aeus. They fought a duel for the ship, but one could not get the other out and use his fire, and the other could not drive him back, now his luck had brought him there. Caletor, Hector's cousin, brought up a torch to fire the ship, but Aeus knocked him down with his pike, and the torch fell from his hand. When Hector saw his cousin down in the dust beside the ship, he called out, "Trojans! Lycians! Brave Dardanians! Don't give way in this narrow place. At least save Caletor, who has fallen here among the ships, or the Achaeans will get his armor." Then he cast a spear at Aeus, missed him, but hit his man Lycophron. He lived with Aeus at home, being banished from Cythera after killing a man. The spear struck the man's head over the ear as he stood beside Aeus, and he tumbled out of the ship to the ground. Aeus shivered and said to his brother, "Don't be lazy, Teucros. Here is our faithful friend Mastorides, dead, who was as dear to us as our own parents and lived in our house. Hector has killed him. Where are your arrows of death? Where is the bow that Phoebus Apollo gave you?" Teucros heard and ran up with bow and quiver. He shot arrow after arrow quickly against the attackers. One hit Clytos, Pisenor's son, the comrade of Polydamas, as he held the reins in his hands. He had trouble with his horses, for he was driving them where the fighting was thickest, to win favor with Hector. But a blow came upon him that no one could help, however much he might wish. For the arrow fell on the back of his neck. He tumbled out of the car, and the horses shied and ran away with the empty car rattling. Polydamas saw this at once, and he was there first to stop them. He gave them over to Astynous, with strict orders to keep them near and watch him. Then he went back to the fighting. Teucros picked out another arrow for Hector, and he would have put an end to the fighting if he had shot the champion, but Zeus was on the watch. He was protecting Hector, and he robbed Teucros of his victory. He broke the bowstring as Teucros drew it at Hector. The bow fell from his hand, and the arrow went off somewhere else. Teucros shivered and said to his brother, "Confound it, look there, how God cuts our plans to pieces. He knocks the bow out of my hand, and he breaks my bowstring, which I put in fresh this morning to stand the strain of all these arrows." Aeus replied, "Don't waste time. Let the bow and arrows lie there, since God has made a mess of them out of spite against our people. Take a long spear and a shield. Fight yourself and make others fight. Aye, make them pay dear for their victory if they do take our ships, and let us remember our duty."
So Teucros put away the bow in his hut. He slung over his shoulders a shield of four hides, and put on a good helmet with a nodding plume of horsehair, and took up a sharp spear. Then he ran quickly to the side of Aias. Hector had seen how the shots had been cut short, and he called out loudly, "Trojans, listen, my brave Dardanian friends, here we are among the ships. Be men, remember your duty and fight. I have just seen the arrows of a champion brought to naught. It is easy to see the mighty hand of Zeus among men, and to discern whom he makes victorious and whom he weakens and will not help, as now he weakens the spirit of our enemies and helps us. Fight, one and all, for the ships. If a man dies by shot or stab, let him be dead. It is no disgrace for him to die fighting for his native land. At least wife is safe and his children after him, house and estate are unhurt, if once the Achaeans go away to their own country." These words put courage into all. Aias, on his part, addressed his companions and roused them to new efforts. "Shame, Argives! Now it is certain we must either drive these men back from the ships or perish. If Hector takes our ships, do you expect to walk all the way home on foot? Don't you hear Hector exhorting all his people to burn our ships with fire? This is a battle, not a dance. For us there is no better plan and no better notion than to have at your enemy man to man. To die at once and have done with it is better than a lingering death. To be squeezed like this among our ships by poor creatures like these." Then Hector killed Schedius, Perimedes' son, the Phocian captain, and Aias killed Laodamas, Antenor's son, captain of the foot. Polydamas brought down Cyllenian Otus, the Epeian prince and friend of Meges Phylides. Meges saw it and leapt upon him, but Polydamas slipped from under him, and Meges missed his thrust, for Apollo would not allow the son of Panthous to be killed there, but he drove the spear full into the chest of Croesmos. He fell, and Meges began to strip off his armor, but Dolops leapt upon him, the bravest of men, son of Lampos and grandson of Laomedon, a man who could use a spear and knew all the art of war. He struck Phylides at close quarters, full on the shield, but he was saved by the plates of his good corselet. This corselet Phyleus had brought out of Ephyra, from the river Celeus. His guest friend, King Euphetes, had given it to him for the war, and this now saved his son's life. Meges next made a stab at the ridge, holding the horsehair plume of his helmet, and cut off the whole plume. Down came the plume and lay scarlet in the dust. While Meges lingered over this fight, hoping to win, Menelaus came to help. He stood behind, unseen, and got Dolops broadside on, then struck at the shoulder. The spear ran through and showed on the other side, as if struggling to get out of his chest, and he fell on his face. The two men dashed forward to take his spoils. Then Hector called upon all his brothers, but first he reproached his cousin Melanippus, Hicataeon's son. This man used to keep his herds of oxen in Pacote before the enemy came, but as soon as the fleet arrived he returned to Ilius and made his mark. He lived in the palace, and Priam treated him like one of his own sons. Hector called him by name with reproaches as he led the way. "What's this, Melanippus? Are we to let him go? Aren't you a bit sorry that your cousin Dolops is killed? Can't you see them fingering his armor? Come along, we can't stand off any more. We must fight till we kill them, or they take Ilios and destroy us all." They were away in a moment, while Telamon Aeneas exhorted his own side. "Be men, my friends. Remember your honor. Remember what your fellows will think of you and your doings in this battle. A little sense of shame will give a better chance for all to live, but he that runs away, that same, will do no good and get no fame." They were full of high spirit as it was, but his familiar saws took their fancy. They fenced in their ships with a paling of hard metal, while Zeus excited the Trojans against them. Now Menelaus called out to Antilochus, "You are younger than the rest of us, Antilochus. No one is quicker on his feet or stronger in the fight. Won't you jump out and have a shot at somebody?" Then he was at it again, while Antilochus jumped out of the first rank and looked round. The Trojans all shrank back as he cast a lance, and that was no miss. Melanippus was then just coming into the battle, and it struck him on the breast. Down he fell with a thud, and Antilochus was upon him in a moment to strip him, like a dog pouncing on a wounded fawn when the hunter has shot it jumping out of its harborage. There was a pounce, Melanippus. But Hector saw it and came up at a run. Antilochus did not stay, but used his own quick feet. He was off like a wild beast which has done something naughty, killed a dog or a herdsman, and then runs before the men come up in a pack. Yes, that was how Nestorides ran, with Hector and all the Trojans coursing after him, shouting and volleying like the devil. When he was safe with his friends, he turned and stood. The Trojans rushed at the ships like ravening lions, fulfilling the will of Zeus, who drove them furiously on, and took all the heart out of the Achaeans as their hope of victory faded. For his will was to give triumph to Hector Priamides, to let him make a burning fiery furnace of the ships, and fulfill the unreasonable prayer of Thetis. He watched for the glare of a burning ship, for at that moment he meant to roll the Trojans back from the ships and give the victory to the Achaeans. That was why he urged Hector to attack when he needed no urging. Hector was mad as spear-shaking Ares, mad as a conflagration in some thick forest upon the mountains. There was foam on Hector's lips. His eyes blazed under the shaggy brows. The helmet shook violently on his temples, for Zeus himself helped him from heaven, and brought him honor and glory, fighting alone amidst a host of foes. For his life was to be but a tiny span. Already the day of fate drew near, when Pallas Athena was to bring out Pelides in his might. He tried again and again to break the enemy ranks, where he saw the men thickest and the armor strongest, but break them he could not for all his ardor. They stood close like great stones in a wall, or like a steep cliff over the sea which endures the swift courses of whistling winds and the swelling breakers that burst against it. So stood the Danaans fast and would not yield. But Hector, shining fiery all about, was dashing against the mass, falling upon it as a billow swells up to the clouds before the wind and falls on a ship. She is swallowed up in foam, the dreadful blast roars against the sail, the mariners tremble with fear, for only a hair's breadth saves them from death. So the Achaeans' hearts were torn within them. But Hector was like a savage lion after the cattle while they graze along a marshy bottom in thousands, and among them a herdsman not certain how to tackle the beast over a mangled heifer. The man keeps pace with the first or last of the herd, but the beast leaps into the middle and gorges his kill while the rest scamper away. So the Achaeans made a rare scampering before Hector and Father Zeus, all but one of whom Hector slew. Mycenaean Periphetes, the son of Copreus, who used to take messages from King Eurystheus to Heracles, the great hero. That mean father begat a son more excellent in every way, fleet of foot and strong to fight first of his people for intelligence. So Hector's victory was the more honorable. The man carried a tall shield that reached to his feet. When he turned, shifting the shield about, he caught his foot in the rim and fell backwards with the helmet banging about his head. Hector heard the noise and ran up and killed him with a thrust in the chest, close beside his friends. But they could do nothing to help him, for they were too much afraid themselves. They were now in among the ships, and the sterns enclosed them. That is the front line. The enemy kept pouring in. Now the Argives were forced to retire and leave their front ships. They remained all together and did not disperse. Both shame and fear restrained them, and they kept calling to one another. Most of all, Geranian Nestor besought every man to listen as he loved his parents. "My friends," he cried, "play the men. Have some respect for the opinion of the world. Remember your wives and children, your property, your parents, alive or dead. Let every man remember. In their names, as you think of them far away, I beseech you to stand firm and not give way to panic." While he thus tried to encourage them, Athena dispersed the rare great mist which blinded their eyes. Now it was bright light on both sides, both about the ships and in the hard-fought battle. They could all see Hector and his companions, both those who were fighting a long way off and those who were near the ships. But Aeneas did not choose to remain standing with the other Achaeans in groups, so he went up and down over the decks of the ships, carrying a huge pike used for sea-fighting, several lengths jointed together, 2 and 20 cubits.
He jumped from deck to deck with long strides, like a skillful horse rider. When such a one has picked out four horses from the rest and tied them together, see him drive them along the high road towards the city. How the men and women run together and stare as he bounds up and down from horse to horse, quite safe all the time, while they gallop along. So Aeneas bounded along, up and down, from deck to deck in long jumps, while his voice resounding filled the sky. And he roared to the Danaans, "Defend your fleet and your camp!" Hector also could not keep still amid his followers, but he swooped upon the black hull of a ship as a brown eagle swoops on a flock of birds feeding by a river, geese or cranes or long-necked swans. And Zeus pressed him from behind with his mighty hand and brought the army with him. Again a bitter fight arose by the ships. You would say there were fresh, unwearied troops now first in the field, so furiously they fought. But the thoughts of the two armies were very different. The Achaeans feared they would never escape destruction. The Trojans hoped one and all to burn the ships and to kill the men. Hector now caught hold of the stern of a fine ship, one which had brought Protesilaus to Troy, but never carried him home again. Achaeans and Trojans fought for possession of that ship, all close work. No waiting now to be shot at with arrows and spears, but all stood close together with one absorbing passion, and they fought with axes and choppers and swords and spears. The ground was covered with fine-wrought blades, dropped from fighting hands, unslung from shoulders. Blood ran in streams. Hector would not let go of the stern, but kept hold of the ensign, calling to his men, "Fire this way and cheer all together! Now Zeus has given us a day which is worth everything. He has given us the ships which came here against the will of heaven and brought us so many troubles, all because the old men were cowards and kept me back and wouldn't let the men go when I wanted to attack the ships. But if Zeus, all-seeing, made us stupid, then now he encourages us and commands us himself." They attacked more violently than ever. Aeneas could no longer stand, for he was overwhelmed with volleys. He left the deck, expecting death at every step, and retired a little way along the 7-foot bridge that led fore and aft. There he remained on guard, repelling anyone who tried to board with fire, and he never ceased roaring, "My friends, brave hearts, true sons of war, prove yourself men, my friends. Remember your duty. Do we think there is anyone behind to help us, or any better wall to save a man from destruction? We have no city near with ramparts to defend us. We have no reserves. We are on the plain of Troy with an armed enemy in front and the sea behind, and our native land far away. Hard hitting must save us. War is no place for kindness." All the while he kept vigorously driving with his pointed spear. Whenever a man rushed at the ship with his fire alight, Aeneas was ready with a prod of the long spear. 12 men he wounded in the fight around the ship. Book 16. How Patroclus took the field in the armor of Achilles, his great feats of war, and his death. While this battle was going on round the ships, Patroclus appeared before Achilles with tears pouring down his cheeks, a veritable fountain, a mountain brook running over the rocks. Achilles was deeply grieved and spoke to him plainly, "My dear Patroclus, why are you crying like a baby? You might be some little girl running to her mother and pulling at her apron and keeping her from her work, and blubbering and looking up and saying, 'Nurse me, mammy dear.' That's what you look like, my dear man, crying like that. Have you some news for the men, or just for me? Or is it a special message from home to you? Why, your father Menoetius is still alive, for all we know, and Peleus Iasides is alive and on his throne. We should be sorry indeed to hear of their deaths. Are you really lamenting for the Achaean people? Can't endure to see them falling thick and fast among the ships? It's their own fault, their own tyrannical dealings. Speak out, don't hide it, then we shall both know." Patroclus answered with a groan, "Don't be angry, Achilles, my prince, our strong deliverer. Such misfortune has come on our people. There they are, all who used to be best in the field, lying wounded, shot or stabbed somewhere among the ships. Diomedes Tydides is wounded, Odysseus is wounded, Agamemnon is wounded, Eurypylus is wounded too, shot in the thigh with an arrow. They have the surgeons busy about them with all their medicines curing the wounds. But there's no curing you, Achilles. I pray I may never have such a grudge in my heart as you have. Curse your courage. What good will you be to anyone from now to the end of the world if you will not save the nation from destruction? Cruel man! Your father was not Peleus, nor your mother Thetis. You are a son of the green sea and the stony rock with that hard heart. If there is some prophecy you are afraid of, which your mother told you from the lips of Zeus, let me go, at least, and take out our Myrmidons, to see if there is any hope in that way. Put your armor upon my shoulders, and perhaps the Trojans may think it is you, and give a little rest to our tormented people. Little time to take your breath face to face with sudden death. And it will be easy for us, coming into the battle fresh, to drive weary men from our camp away to their city. So he prayed, poor fool, for his prayer was destined to bring death and destruction for himself. Achilles replied in hot anger, "Ah, what have you said, Patroclus, my dear friend? I care for no prophecy, if I do know any. My mother has told me none from the lips of Zeus. But I feel bitter grief in my heart, when here is a man who will rob his equal and take back his prize, because he is the stronger. This is a terrible grief to me, and this has been my torment. The girl that the army chose out for my prize, whom I made my own by force of arms when I took that city, that girl my lord King Agamemnon tore from my hands as if I were a foreigner without any rights. But we will let bygones be bygones. I see it was impossible to bear resentment forever and ever. I did think I should not forget my resentment until fire and battle came to my own ships. You go, then, put on my armor and lead our brave men into the field, now the enemy have swallowed up the Achaean ships like a great cloud, now that our people have their backs to the sea and only a small space is left them to hold, now that all Troy is here, confident, for they see not the face of my helmet shining near them. That would soon rout them and fill the gullies with their dead, if my lord King Agamemnon were kind to me. But now they are fighting round our camp. There is no spear in the hands of Diomedes Tydides, furiously raging to defend the Danians from ruin. I have not heard yet the voice of my lord king shouting out of his hateful head. But Hector's words of command are breaking upon me all round. His Trojans cover the whole plain with their clamor. They vanquish the Achaeans in fair fight. Never mind. Fall on them and beat them, Patroclus. Save our ships, or they will burn them, and we shall never see home again. But listen carefully while I tell you exactly what to do, that you may win honor and glory for me from the whole nation, and they may send back that lovely girl and handsome gifts besides. When you have cleared them away from the ships, come straight back. If, after that, the loud-thundering Lord of Hera gives you a chance of triumph, never think of fighting on your own account without me. You will steal my honors in that way. Don't be excited by fighting and victory, so as to lead our men as far as the city walls, or one of the Olympian gods may meddle. Apollo Shutafar is very fond of them. You must turn back as soon as you have saved the ships, and let them ravage the plain. Oh, Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo! If only not one single Trojan could be left alive, and not one Achaean but you and I might be left, that we alone might tear off the sacred diadem of Troy. By this time, Aeus was at the end of his endurance under the showers of blows. He had two forces against him, the will of Zeus and the volleys of the Trojans. The metal of his helmet rang and rattled as the blows beat and beat upon the knobs. His left shoulder was tired with bearing the heavy shield so long, but nothing could shake him, stab and strike as they would. His breath came hard, sweat poured in streams over every limb. He had not a moment's rest, nothing but trouble upon trouble everywhere. Oh, ye divine spirits that inspire the songs of men, help me to tell how the fire first fell upon the Achaean ships. Hector drew near and struck the ashen pike of Aeus with his great sword, at the end, near the socket, and cut it straight through. Aeus brandished the useless pole, and the blade fell on the ground with a clang a long way off. Then Aeus shuddered, for he saw in this the act of God. He knew that Zeus' thunderer was foiling his plans of battle, and meant to let the Trojans win, and he retired out of reach. Then they cast fire upon the ship. It lapped round the stern and blazed up at once all over the ship. And then Achilles slapped his two thighs, crying out, "Hurry, Patroclus, my friend, be off with your horses. I see fire sweeping about the ships. I fear they may take the ships, and then we shall never get away. On with your armor, and I will wake up the men." Patroclus lost no time. He put on his legs the greaves with silver anklets, next covered his chest with the star-bespangled corselet of Iasides. Over his shoulders he slung the sword with bronze blade and silver knob, and then the great strong shield. Upon his head he set the helmet with its plume, nodding defiance. He took two lances that fitted his grip, but not the spear of Iasides, for only Achilles could wield that huge heavy pike, not another man in the Achaean host. This was the strong ashen spear from Mount Pelion, which Chiron had given his father to be the terror of his enemies. The horses he put in charge of Automedon, whom he thought more of than any except Achilles himself, and he trusted him best to be ready at his call in battle. So Automedon harnessed the horses, Chestnut Xanthos and Piebald Balius, swift as the winds. West Wind Zephyros was their sire, and their dam, the Harpy Podagra, got in foal while grazing in a meadow beside the stream of Oceanus. In the side traces he put one mortal horse with the pair of immortals, Pedasus, the incomparable, which Achilles had brought back from captured Thebe. Meanwhile Achilles had got the men under arms and marshaled in their camp. They were like a pack of ravening wolves ready for the hunt. How the savage beasts bring down a great antlered stag in the mountains and tear him to pieces with blood-dripping jaws. Then off goes the whole pack to a brook, and they lap up the clear surface water with long thin tongues, belching out clots of gore. Their courage is high as ever, though their bellies are stuffed. So the Myrmidon leaders and captains bustled about Patroclus, while Achilles was among them, marshalling the chariots and ranks of armed men. 50 ships of war was the fleet which Achilles had brought to Troy. In each were 50 stout fellows on the benches, 5 officers he appointed to command them, under himself commanding in chief. One division was led by Menestheus in his resplendent corselet. His mother was Peleus' daughter, the fair Polydora, a mortal woman. His father the river guards Percios, but by repute one Boris, Perieres' son, who brought his bride gifts and wedded her in due form. The second was led by warlike Eudorus, a girl's love-child. His mother, the dancing beauty Polymele, was daughter of Phylas. Hermes Agiophontes caught sight of her when the girls were singing on the dancing ground of golden reed Artemis, lady of the noisy hunt. Hermes at once fell in love. Climbing to her chamber, he lay with her secretly, and she gave him a splendid son, Eudorus, fleet of foot and strong to fight. When at last our Lady of Childbirth had brought him to the light, and he saw the rays of the sun, Iecles, Actor's son, paid his court and made her his wife. Old Phylas brought him up with the same love and kindness as if he were his own son. The third was led by Pisandros Mimalades, who was the most renowned spearman in the country after Patroclus. The fourth was under Phoenix, the fifth under Alcimedon, the son of Laerces. As soon as Achilles had arranged them all in their ranks, he gave his last orders in these stern words. "Myrmidons, do not forget all those threats of yours against the Trojans here in camp, and how you have reproached me while my resentment lasted. Would you not say, 'Hard-hearted man, you must have sucked bile from your mother's breast, cruel man, to keep us here against our will. At least let us sail away and go back home, since this poisonous bile is in your heart.' How often you came, crowding, to talk at me like that. Now here is the great battle you were enamored of, plain to see. Then let every man keep a stout heart and fight." As they heard this rousing speech from their king, they closed their ranks more firmly. Helmets and shields were packed together like the squared stones of a wall which a man builds to keep the strong winds outside his house. Shield pressed on shield, helmet on helmet, man on man. The horsehair plumes on the shining horns nodded and touched, so close they stood. In front of all, 2 men made ready for battle, Patroclus and Automedon, 2 men with one mind to lead the Myrmidons forward.
Achilles returned to his quarters and opened the lid of a fine carven chest, which Thetis Silverfoot had put on board ship for him, full of shirts and woolen rugs and cloaks to keep off the wind. In this was a goblet of fine work. No other man but he ever drank wine from it. No god was honored with libations from that goblet save Zeus the Father alone. This he took out, and first cleansed it with sulphur, then washed it in clean water, and washed his own hands. Last he ladled wine into it, and stood in the midst of the courtyard and prayed as he spilt the wine, looking up into heaven. Zeus, Thunderer, saw him without fail. O Lord Zeus, Dodonian, Pelasgian, whose habitation is far away, O thou ruler of tempestuous Dodona, and about thee the Seloe dwell, thy interpreters, foot unwashen, ground-bedded. Once indeed thou didst hear the words of my prayer, thou didst honour me, and thou didst strike hard upon the Achaeans. Then grant me now also the boon I crave. I will remain myself where the ships are gathered together, but I send my comrade with many men to fight. Send victory with him, Zeus all-seeing. Make bold the heart in him, that Hector may learn whether my man knows how to fight alone, or whether his hands are invincible only when I go myself into the maw of war. But when he has driven the battle away from the ships, I pray that he may come back unscathed, with all his armor and his warlike companions. Such was his prayer, and Zeus all-wise heard him. Half he granted, and half he refused. To drive the battle away from the ships, he granted. To return safe out of battle, he refused. Achilles, after his libation and prayer, went into the hut and put away the goblet in the chest. Then he went outside and stood. He still longed to see the battle himself. Patroclus and his force marched on until they found the Trojans. They were like a swarm of wasps, with a nest by the road, which boys have been teasing and poking in their way. The poor little fools only stir up trouble for everybody, and if a wayfarer disturbs the wasps by accident, they pour out in fury and defend their home. Just as furious were the Myrmidons when they poured out of their camp with a great noise. Patroclus cried out in a loud voice, "Myrmidons, fellow soldiers of our prince, be men, remember your old valor. Let us win honor for Pelides, who is the best man in this army, and his soldiers are second to none. Let my lord King Agamemnon know his blind madness when he made no account of the best man of all our nation." Then with courage refreshed they fell on the Trojans in a swarm, and the ships around resounded with the noise of their shouting. But when the Trojans saw Patroclus and his companions in their shining armor, they were amazed, and the ranks wavered, for they believed that Achilles had thrown off his resentment and made friends again. Every man looked about him for some escape from certain death. Patroclus first cast a spear into the thick of the struggle near the stern of Protesilaus' ship, and hit Pyrechmes. This was the leader of the Paeonians, who came with chariots from Amydon on the Axios. The spear went into his right shoulder, and he fell on his back, groaning, while his Paeonians fled in all directions, for they were panic-stricken when Patroclus brought down their leader and champion. He drove them away from the ships and quenched the fire. The Trojans fled in rare confusion, leaving the half-burnt ship, and the Danaans poured in among the ships with a deafening din. As the fire was quenched and the smoke dispersed, it seemed as when Zeus disperses a thick cloud from a mountain top, and light breaks through from the infinite air of heaven, showing the peaks and pinnacles of the rocks. Then the Danaans had time to breathe for a little, but the battle was not over. The Trojans still held their ground, although they had been forced to leave the ships, and they were not yet running pell-mell in rout. There were a number of scattered combats here and there. First Patroclus pierced the thigh of Areilicus at the moment he turned to fly. The spear broke the bone, and he fell flat on his face. Next Menelaus wounded Thoas, where his chest showed over the side of the shield, and he collapsed. Phylades watched his moment as Amphiclus ran at him and lunged at him first, hit the bulging thigh where the muscle is thickest, and cut through the sinews, and darkness came over his eyes.
Nestor's two sons each brought down his man. Antilochus drove his spear into the flank of Atymnius. His brother Maris ran in front of the body and made a thrust at Antilochus, but Thrasymedes got in first before he could strike and tore the upper arm from the muscles, breaking the bone and killing the man. So the two sons of Nestor sent down to Erebus the two valiant sons of Amisodorus, the man who bred that raging, destructive monster, the Chimera. They were Sarpedon's men. Aesculides leapt at Cleobulus and took him alive when he was hampered in the crowd, but he cut his throat with his sword and killed him on the spot. All the blade grew hot with the blood as death took him. Peneleus and Lycon cast at each other at the same time, and both missed. They ran together and fell too with swords. Lycon sliced at the horn of the other's helmet, and his sword broke off at the hilt. Peneleus struck his neck under the ear, and the blade cut so deep that the head hung over to one side, held only by the skin. Meriones ran and caught Acamas as he was mounting his chariot and stabbed him in the right shoulder. He fell off, and his eyes were dimmed. Idomeneus stabbed Erymas in the mouth. The point came out under the brain and broke the bones. His teeth were knocked out, and both his eyes filled with blood, which spurted up through nostrils and mouth as he gaped. Then the dark cloud of death spread over him. These Danian leaders got each his man. The rest of the Danians pounced on their enemies as ferocious wolves pick out lambs and kids from the flock and pounce on them when a careless shepherd has let them go straying over the hills. They tear the poor timid creatures to pieces at sight. And so did the Danians, while the Trojans forgot they had ever been brave, but remembered to run as if flight had no disgrace. Big Ears made a dead set at Hector, determined to spear him. But Hector knew all the tricks of war. He kept his broad shoulders covered with the good oxhide and watched the whizzing arrows and thudding spears. He knew well enough that the tide had turned and victory was lost. All the same, he stood firm and saved his companions. But now the rout and confusion spread from the ships, as when Zeus spreads the tempest and the cloud comes into the open from the upper air. Now they were all pouring back in a rabble. Hector in his galloping car left the Trojan army as they were trying to get over the moat which was in their way. Many a team galloped off, leaving their master's chariots in the ditch with broken poles. But Patroclus was close behind, loudly crying, "Kill! Kill!" as the broken hordes filled every path with noise and confusion. The dust rose in clouds. The horses tugged and strained to get clear of the camp. Patroclus drove, shouting, wherever he saw the thickest crowd. Men kept falling out of their cars under his axle trees. The cars tumbled over clittery-clattery. Straight over the moat galloped the horses, on and on. "Down with Hector!" was the cry of his heart. To strike down Hector was his one passion. But Hector was far ahead. Panting horses were everywhere, running loose like a roaring torrent when a thundercloud in the autumn pours heavy cataracts on the black earth. The rivers rise in flood, crundles and dimbles are full, and ravines are cut in the mountains. Down come the torrents, tumbling crisscross out of the hills, and destroying the works of men until they fall roaring into the sea. Such is the vengeance of Zeus upon men who give unrighteous judgments and drive justice far from them, having no regard for the wrath of heaven. Patroclus cut off the front of the routed army and then drove them back towards the ships. He would not let them get back to their city, but kept them in the space between ships and the river and the city walls, charging and slaying until he had exacted the price of many lives. First he struck Pronous and killed him when the shield uncovered his chest. Next he drove at Thestor, who was crouching down in his chariot, dazed with terror. The reins dropped from his hands. Patroclus came quite close and stabbed him in the right jaw through teeth and all, then dragged him gaping over the rail by the spear and threw him down on his face, as a man sitting on a rock lands a big fish with hook and line. Erylaus rushed at him, but Patroclus smashed his head to pieces in the helmet with a stone and brought him down. Then he attacked one after another, Erymas and Amphoterus and Epaltes, Tlepolemus Damastorides, Echios and Pyrrhus, Iphius and Euippus and Polymelos Argeides, and laid them all flat on the ground. Sarpedon saw his countrymen falling. He knew them by their dress, for they wore no loin guard, and he called to them in reproach, "Shame, Lycians! Where are you running? Play up, men! I will meet this man myself. I want to know who he is that sweeps everything before him. Look how many good men and true he has killed." Then he jumped out of the car in his armor, and Patroclus, when he saw, did the same. They leapt at each other, yelling like a couple of vultures on a high rock, shrieking and fighting with beak and claw. When Zeus saw them, he said to Hera, "This is very sad. Sarpedon, whom I love best of all men, is fated to be killed by Patroclus Menetiades. I really don't know what to do. Shall I pick him up out of the battle alive and put him down in his own country, or shall I let him be killed by Menetiades?" Hera said, "Oh, you dreadful creature, you mustn't say that. A mortal man doomed of old by fate, and you want to rescue him from death? Do as you like, but you cannot expect the rest of us gods to approve. Think for a moment. If you send Sarpedon home alive, some other god may want to take his son out of the battlefield. He loves his son too, you know. Many of the immortals have sons fighting before Troy, and you will make them all very jealous. But if you do love him, if you are sorry for him, just let him be killed by Patroclus Menetiades. But as soon as he is dead and done for, send death and sleep to carry him back to Lycia, where his family and friends will do the funeral honors with barrow and pillar, for that is the privilege of the dead." The father of men and gods agreed that this was right, but he sent a shower of bloody raindrops upon the earth in honor of his dear son, whom Patroclus was destined to kill on Trojan soil, far from his native land. When they were within reach, Patroclus struck Thrasymelos, Sarpedon's man, in the lower belly and brought him down. Sarpedon cast at Patroclus and missed, but he hit the horse, Pedasus, in the right shoulder. The horse fell, crashing in the dust, and gasped out his life with a moan. The other two sprang apart with a crack of the yoke, entangling the reins above them. Automedon mended matters by drawing his sword and cutting loose the trace horse. Then the others were righted and drew the reins taut. The two men now came together again for their battle. Sarpedon cast, and the spear passed over Patroclus' left shoulder without touching. Patroclus followed up, and there was no mistake about his cast. He struck where the midriff encloses the beating heart. Sarpedon fell as an oak tree falls, or a poplar, or a tall pine felled by a woodman to make a ship's mast. So he lay in front of his horses and chariot, moaning and clutching at the bloody dust. Like a bull that a lion kills, he tracks a herd and leaps on the bull, and the strong-hearted creature groans in his death between the lion's jaws. So under the blow of Patroclus, the strong heart of the Lycian warrior struggled with death, and he called his comrade by name. "Waste no time, Glaucus. You are a warrior among men. Now ply your spear and show yourself a warrior. Now let dreadful war be your heart's desire if you are good at need. First, bring up all our best men to fight for Sarpedon. Then fight yourself with your own blade. I shall be your shame and disgrace all your days forever if the Achaeans strip me fallen before their own ships. Stand firm and bring up our people, all." Even as he spoke, the end came, and death closed his eyes and nostrils. Patroclus set foot on his breast and pulled out the spear, bringing the midriff with it. He dragged out life and blade together. His myrmidons caught the panting horses, which would have run away now that the chariot had lost its masters. But Glaucus heard these last words with bitter pain. His heart was wrung that he could not help. He took hold of his arm and pressed it, for he was in great pain from the arrow where Teucros shot him in his attack on the wall, and he prayed aloud to Apollo Shutafar, "Hear me, Lord, in the happy land of Lycia, or in Troy. Thou hast power everywhere to hear an afflicted man as I am afflicted now. Here I have a cruel wound. My arm throbs from side to side with sharp pains. The blood will not dry. My shoulder is heavy. I cannot hold a spear steady or go and fight with my enemies. A man is slain, the best of men, Sarpedon, the son of Zeus. But the father helps not the son. I beseech thee, Lord, heal this cruel wound. Lull the pains, give me strength that I may summon my comrades and make them fight, and fight myself for the body of my dead." Apollo heard his prayer, In a moment he stilled the pains. He dried the blood that ran from the wound. He put courage into the man. Glaucus knew it in his heart, and he was glad that the god had quickly heard his prayer. First he went round, urging the Lycian leaders to fight for Sarpedon. Then he repaired at good pace to the Trojans, Polydamas and Panthoides and Agenor, Aeneas and Hector the mighty man himself, calling upon them in plain words, "Look here, Hector, you have quite forgotten your allies. They wear themselves out for your sake, far from home and friends, and you will not help them. Sarpedon lies dead, the leader of the Lycian spearmen, who ruled his country with justice and his own strong arm. Brazen Ares has brought him down by the spear of Patroclus. Do stand by us, friends. Let your hearts be moved with indignation. Do not suffer the Myrmidons to strip him and maltreat his body in revenge for the Danaans whom we have killed in fair fight beside their own ships." The Trojans were thrilled with grief, every inch of them, pangs intolerable, unendurable. For he was the mainstay of their city, although a foreigner. There was a large force with him, and he was ever their champion in the field. They went straight for the enemy at full speed, led by Hector, eager for revenge. But the Achaeans were set on by the rousing voice of great-heart Patroclus Menetiades. He began by calling Aias and his namesake, who were ready enough. "Now then, Telamonian, now then, runner, let it be your pleasure to have at the enemy. Be as good as you ever were, or better. Sarpedon lies dead, the first man who jumped upon our wall. Come along, if only we can revenge ourselves on his body and strip the armor from his shoulders."